We're waiting for a few more folks to file in. It's 11:01. My name is Joe Whitcomb. I want to say good morning to everybody on Mountain and Pacific time. Good afternoon to everybody on Central and East Coast. My name is Joe Whitcomb, and joining me today is Joel Hemner and Danny Tiroli. Danny will be moderating today. First, I want to thank everyone who has taken the time out of your busy schedules to show up today for this webinar. We hope it'll be informational and useful to everyone who's joining us. Again, my name is Joe Whitcomb. I founded a law firm in 2012, and our firm has been helping small businesses, specifically in the socioeconomic space, since 2013, relevant to the universe of government contracting. Our primary focus since 2013 has been on SDD OSBs, but obviously, and in their efforts in winning, maintaining, and collecting on government contracts in which they're performing. Because of that work, we've had a lot of conversations with existing and prospective clients whose problems, in our view of the world, who could have been meaningfully reduced or curtailed if they had taken action earlier in the procurement process. So that is why we are focused today on the early part of the procurement process, why today's meeting is about starting before the procurement process and taking advantage of the Q&A process. We're going to break this webinar down into two sections. The first 20 minutes is going to be just a facilitated conversation between Danny, Joel, and myself. I'm going over a list of questions that we've prepared in anticipation of this webinar. And then the last 10 minutes of the 30 minutes will be dedicated to answering your questions that you guys have as they may give way. And again, you'll see some chats pop up in, instructing you on maybe using the chat bar, of course, using the Q&A as a way to get questions over. But understand that we will be focused on those questions in the last 10 minutes. We hope we address enough in the first 20 that you won't have a lot of questions, but if you do, please feel free to use it those last 10 minutes. And then again, any questions that we're not able to answer in this 30-minute segment that we've got over that we feel like, you know, we'll put together a response, send you over a personalized video for you guys to be able to review. And of course, we're always available through email if you have questions. And with that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Danny, short for Daniela, to start with our questions.
So I guess to start things off, you guys suggest that we start the RFPs before the process. So why don't you explain exactly what you mean by that?
Sure. Right.
Joel, you want to take that question?
Yeah. So I'll kick it off here. And this is the first in a series of five webinars where we kind of talked about the disproportionate power, right, balance sometimes that it seems to exist between contractors and the federal government, particularly small businesses. And so starting before the RFP even comes out, is vital to preparation, right? When you are in this David and Goliath type interaction. And so what we mean about starting before the RFP is really just actively tracking and appropriately responding to RFIs and sources sought when those documents and other related information comes out.
Yep. One of the things that Joel and I were talking about before is like, what kind of things are you as contractors going to be looking for in those documents, right? The first thing you'll learn, obviously, is, you know, what is the government trying to purchase by way of goods or services? The second, maybe equally important thing you'll learn is, how does the government plan to procure this? In other words, is it going to use a blanket purchase agreement? Is it going to use a negotiated procurement? Does it plan to use, if it comes out on e-buy, that's a good indication that they're going to be using federal supply schedules, or what you may refer to as the GSA schedule. And it's important for you to know as a contractor, you know, is this pie going to be split between 5 or 10 contractors in the sense of like an IDIQ or a MATOC, or is this going to be, you know, a single award to a single awardee? And one of the things you can do in looking at those early documents is just determine whether or not, you know, this is a good fit for your company. You have the bandwidth to perform, because as we will get into, as Joel hinted at, as we get further on in our seminars, we'll talk about the consequences of maybe, you know, getting awarded a contract for which you're maybe not 100% prepared for. So that those sources sought in those RFIs can help you with that. And then lastly, for this audience, you might be looking to see whether or not it's set aside for socioeconomic. Is it an STD OSB? Is it a small business set aside? Or is this an open compete?
Yeah, Joe, I'll just jump on that and say, additionally, responding to RFIs or sources sought when they come out is also vitally important in a set-aside context. Oftentimes, that is a critical component, sometimes even the only component, of market research that a contracting officer may do. And so by responding to actively monitoring, tracking, and then responding to those types of documents, RFIs, sources sought, that is what will, you know, maybe not necessarily ensure, but certainly tip the scales in favor of this particular procurement effort being set aside for something that you may qualify for.
Absolutely.
So now my question after that would have to be, if a contractor doesn't respond to an RFI or sources sought, can that contractor still submit a bid?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but piggybacking off what Joel was saying is, if you as a service-disabled veteran-owned small business or veteran-owned small business or even a small business don't respond to that RFI or sources sought, then that may deprive you of the ability to later complain, and as Joel and I will get into in this seminar, to be able to later complain about the fact that the contract was not set aside. A lot of our clients do business, particularly with the Veterans Administration. I try to encourage every client, prospective client, that's a STVOSB or VOSB, make sure you respond to those RFIs or sources sought, because otherwise the contracting officer may, not always, but may use the lack of responses as an excuse to not set aside that contract in the future. But to Danny's question, you can absolutely and should respond. That's actually key to making sure that your rights further in the procurement process are preserved. If you don't submit a bid, then your opportunity to complain later will of course evaporate.
Absolutely.
So with that being said, what do you think that the most important part of solicitation is that the contractor should be reading?
Well, Joe, you came up with this question. Someone let you run.
Yeah, so I'll jump on that. So, you know, that certainly is a loaded question. What's the most important part of the solicitation? So now we have moved beyond that pre-RFP stage, and we have actually seen the solicitation. What we see oftentimes is that contractors will tend to just go right straight to the sow, right? The statement of work or the performance work statement, however it is styled in that particular solicitation, and bypass a whole host of other issues that are extremely relevant for how to prepare a properly responsive proposal. If I were to pick one key aspect, I would say you must be aware and have intimate knowledge of the source selection criteria, right, in the evaluation methodology. That is going to inform you exactly how you're going to style your proposal. It's going to inform you what information needs to be included and what doesn't need to be included. Sometimes we run into issues where contractors maybe have included information that might not necessarily be necessary, but then ultimately the contracting officer uses that overabundance of information, right, to find a reason to exclude that contractor from consideration of the award. But of course, I mean, there are a host of other points along the way that, of course, we need to be mindful of, everything from understanding what's the contract type, what's the period of performance, what's the set-aside criteria, which we've mentioned previously, and certainly perusing, right, the long list of FAR or other agency clauses, really looking to see whether there are any clauses that might not necessarily be applicable, that might should be removed from that, whether there are any other conflicting provisions that might exist there too.
Yeah, I would just piggyback on Joel's response and say also be on the lookout as the technical experts in your field for the things that just don't make a lot of sense, right? There may be instances or which are completely unclear. If you're a construction contractor and the request for bids in this example doesn't include things that you as a performer would just know they are necessary, right? That is absolutely goes into our next point, which is how to leverage that Q&A period. So looking for those ambiguities, looking for things that just don't make sense to you as the technical expert, and then getting, you know, enumerating, putting a list together of things that you need clarification on in order for you to be able to best prepare. Because where you don't want to be is just feeling your way around in the dark, putting together a proposal, and for reasons we'll discuss, you know, today and in future webinars, and then waiting until the award to complain that, oh, well, I didn't understand the request for proposals or the request for bids or the or what have you, or the request for quotes. So that's super important. As Joel said, how is this thing being competed? Is it, you know, is it under FAR Part 15? Are discussions available? Am I going to get a debriefing? Is the government
asked? Is it DOD acquisition?
That's right. Exactly. What agency? And then maybe most importantly, ladies and gentlemen, when are my submissions due? Because if it turns out you open this RFP and you have a huge effort, and the response, you see this happen a lot in late August and early September, the responses are due in a week. Well, the first thing that should, the first alarm bell that should go off is, well, that's completely unreasonable. There's no way that they can expect us to respond to that. That might be the time to either reach out to the contracting officer or send them an email and say, hey, this, you know, this should at least be a 30-day response. So those are the things that I would suggest complement what Joel was saying.
So of course this all can be very overwhelming. So in the question and answer phase can alleviate some of those concerns. Now, is the contracting staff required to provide question and answer period during every solicitation?
I'll take that. So the response to that is sure, right? If they put out something that's unclear and you submit questions and they don't respond, then what they're leaving you, the only choice they're leaving you with is to rush in with a pre-award bid protest and complain about patent ambiguities or a defective solicitation protest, as they're sometimes styled. And that's, you know, so the answer is if they don't respond to your Q&A, then they've ultimately forced your hand and forced you to litigate as it relates to these the lack of clarity. Now, will the government sometimes respond with answers that are not terribly helpful, like see paragraph 10.13 in the solicitation? Absolutely. And you should still be prepared to escalate, but understand that your deadline for complaining about those unclear clauses or those unclear evaluation criteria is the date and time of when responses are due. So if your responses are due in, you know, at noon on, you know, August 30th, then that's the latest you have to clear up any of those ambiguities or to file a protest and force the government's hand.
So do you have any suggestions then what helpful questions you would suggest to pose?
Yeah, I'll jump on that. The first that you've referenced at length here, Joe, is to clarify ambiguities. As you talk about that, I remember a recent issue that we had where we saw a solicitation that listed both that the evaluation criteria would employ both an LPTA and a best value determination, right? Which just is nonsensical. Under the FAR and under the provisions of the FAR. And so certainly clarifying whether that be technical ambiguities or contractual ambiguities. Another thing that we've mentioned already today is seeking to have removed inapplicable terms, inapplicable FAR Part 52 flow down clauses that may not apply. That's a prime opportunity to raise that in a Q&A, right? You say, look, I see that this clause was flowed down. You have, for example, set aside the procurement as this type of a set aside. This particular clause may not apply. And normally then, I mean, it depends on the contracting officer, the type of response that you'll get, but you'll get some type of a response either that's inapplicable or sure, we'll remove. Occasionally, you'll run into an issue where the contracting officer is somewhat recalcitrant and dug in and, well, it says what it says. It is what it is. I think one of the biggest things, though, and one of the most important things you can do with a Q&A comes back to the theme of this David versus Goliath dynamic that sometimes occurs, particularly again with small businesses seeking a contract with the federal government. And that is that your Q&A is a chance to certainly clarify issues, but it's also an opportunity to pin the government down, pin the contracting officer down, and how they're going to either execute the contract or follow through on their on making their award decision. We recently had another instance in which a contractor reached out to us and said, hey, I see a couple of these terms. They're unique. I haven't seen them in a procurement like this before, and they cause me concern. I have some concerns about that. What can we do in the Q&A process to approach those? And so what we did is that we developed a few questions that said, hey, you know, I see term X says this, right? FAR provision Y requires that. How do you, government, intend to meet the requirements of the FAR provision when you do this? And what that ultimately is going to do is that the government is going to ultimately articulate their process and say, well, we intend to do these things to ensure that the regulations are met. And now they have essentially committed themselves to that. And if they fail to follow through on that, then you will always be able to point back to that question. Those questions become part of the solicitation. They're incorporated into that solicitation.
There's one thing I want to add to what Joel was saying. In that same vein, when you're looking at these FAR provisions or you're looking at, look for any sort of, again, as the technical experts, look for a major departure on how the government is purchasing a good or service. We've seen recent examples, and in the term of art that we lawyers like to throw around without thinking about our audience is bundling, as an example, or consolidating, which is covered under FAR Part 7. So a recent example was the Social Security Administration taking what was previously 1,000 individual contracts covered under a BPA and consolidating them, and that was all over the country. I understand there's 170 hearing offices and 1,700 judges, and they consolidated those contracts into 5 contracts across the country. And that was the government's allowed to do that. But there's also a process the government has to go through to ensure that kind of bundling or consolidating doesn't negatively impact small businesses or STVOSB. So look for something that's very different. I've seen construction contracts where the government attempted to award a MATOC to the entire East Coast, or a furniture contract that they were going to distribute across the entire country in 5 regions. And that by its very definition, might make it super, super difficult for a small business that is operating under the size standards of the SBA, right, to be able to perform. I mean, if you're $11 million company or $37 million general contractor, it may not be realistic for you to be able to compete on that contract, and it may be important for you to go in and press the government and say, hey, did you do a procurement plan? Did you get the SBA's input on how this is going to hurt or impact small businesses? And if the answer to that question is no, then that might throw open the doors for litigating or forcing the government's hand on that front.
So with that being said, the question and answer phase can ensure certain performance out of the government. Can the question and answer phase also hurt you? For example, if you file a legal action, is there a risk of losing the contract?
I'll take that one. Sure. So the legal answer to that question is absolutely not. That's retaliation. They're not allowed to do that. That's a different answer from what may play out in the reality. In other words, know that if the contracting officer or the contracting staff does that, they are acting illegally, and they could even go so far as to limit. They all these contracting officers work with a certain level of immunity as it relates to private actions against them. If they go so far afield and start retaliating against you individually, they may cross over into a universe of what we lawyers refer to as bad faith. And if they cross over into that universe, that can change the game completely. So again, the legal answer is no, they're not supposed to be able to do that, and no, they shouldn't. And if they do, they will create legal recourse for you. And again, I think the other piece of it is just using the Q&A, being as politically forthcoming and upfront as you can be, not being combative, asking questions, that are that you need answers to. And then you have all of those documents that you can present to the GAO or the Court of Federal Claims or whatever route you decide to go and say, look, you know, these are all the opportunities we gave the government to answer these questions. They dug in their heels, and then let them answer to the GAO or the Court of Federal Claims judge for not responding.
Okay. Joe, there's a question here to kind of repeat that question about the legal action. And so I want to pick up on a couple of things you said, but I'll simply say the question was, do you as a contractor open yourself up to any potential adverse consequences, right? If you take a hard line on a Q&A or potentially even, you know, file a bid protest or otherwise litigate a claim. And so certainly, yeah, to your point, Joe, no, the government is precluded by law from holding that against you, right? That obviously is your legal right to be able to take any of those. That said, of course, right, there are pragmatic considerations. When we, again, kind of hearkening back to this most recent example that we dealt with, where we developed some specific questions that seemed to get at what we thought were likely difficult terms, right, for the government to be able to support and potentially at odds with certain FAR provisions. Really, it's just taking a matter of fact approach, right, and laying before the government to say, you know, the regulations say X, your term says Y. And then just ask the question, how do you reconcile these two? How do you intend to follow through on ensuring that X is followed? You can do that in a political way, right? And in a good way, because of course they are still are your government customer. But fortunately in the world of government contracting, you're right, they are precluded, Joe, from holding that against you.
And what I want to, so again, I'm going to, maybe this will be the last word on this. Whatever danger you may encounter from using the Q&A and even using the litigation is far outweighed by the risk you take in being silent. Because if you are silent, especially when the law is super clear, if you're silent about a super ambiguous clause in the contract, it's just completely unclear, and you don't complain about it before the solicitation responses are due, then you can, the government will be the first ones to tell you in your bid protest when you don't win, hey, you should have brought that up before the award. So they will certainly use your silence against you as readily as they might illegally use your questions against you, if that makes sense. So, whatever, again, I just don't know how to put it more plainly than whatever risk you run from being overly verbose, you run a bigger risk from being too silent. And I see now that we're at 11:24. We want to be respectful of everybody's time. We have two questions that have shown up in our Q&A. I don't know if there's any others on the chat, but I want to take the first question, which talks about the limitations of subcontracting. And the question is, how do you bring this up with contracting? And when you know that the incumbent has hired all subcontractors, no W-2 employees. So that's a question that we could probably spend a whole 20 minutes in. And this, our team in this firm has litigated this issue on the limitations on subcontracting a great deal. So the way the courts come down on that is that the limitations in subcontracting is an issue of contract administration. It is up to the contracting officer to make sure that the limitations in subcontracting are followed, meaning that if it's an SDVOSB set aside, as an example, that the prime contractor, you, those within the sound of my voice, do not subcontract more than 50% of that contract value out to other than similarly situated, you know, other SDVOSBs, to put it simply. So if you're going to subcontract to a small business or a large contractor that's not an SDVOSB, then your floor is, you know, or your ceiling rather, is that 50% mark of that contract value. If it's a $1 million contract, don't subcontract more than $500,000 There's a little bit of nuance math in there. You can remove your cost in a construction contract. Obviously, in a construction contract, the math is different because it's 15%, 85. But in a services contract, you can't subcontract more than 50%, or in a manufacturing contract, other than similarly situated. Now, what do you do? I think the question is, what do you do when you learn out that you find out that the incumbent has been violating that, or that the awardee has been violating? Well, then you can. You get into the universe of protesting at the SBA about of sensible subcontracting and whether they're complying with the limitations of subcontracting. You can use responsibility determinations to complain. And ultimately, if you really want to opt for the nuclear option, if you're really convinced that the awardee is not complying with the law and has represented to the government that they are, then you have a QI-TAM action or a False Claims Act action after the award. And you know, we will unpack that issue in later webinars because that's a big deal. If you bring a QI-TAM action against another contractor and stating that, hey, you know, they were awarded under a set aside, they haven't complied with the limitations in subcontracting, the penalties around 13 CFR 125.6, which is what governs that limitations in subcontracting, are huge. The minimum penalty is $500,000. That's enormous. And that's statutory, which means the judges don't even have any discretion as to whether or not they levy that penalty. And usually that involves the DOJ. And it is. So it is not anything to be taken lightly. And so if you're the contractor and you're like, well, I'm competing against people who are not playing by the rules, then unfortunately your recourse is that, you know, if they're awarded and they're not complying, then you know, you could ultimately bring a QI-TAM or a False Claims Act. Now they essentially have 6 months of that first year contract performance to get into compliance, right? Because the measure of whether they're satisfying that limitations in subcontracting is that full base year. So they have, you know, they could theoretically subcontract out 100% of the contract and then on day 179, pick up full performance and carry it out for the rest of the year, and they'd be compliant. But to the questioners, to Todd's question, you know, you can alert the contracting officer. Then your job is ultimately, if the contracting officer just sort of winks at the error, then your job is really just go to the DOJ and bring it up there.
Right. One thing, Joe, that you mentioned is, you know, obviously you mentioned stiff penalties related to that. And I would just underscore, and it's because it gets to the heart of how these set-asides work. You mentioned in passing the ostensible contract subcontractor rule. That's basically a rule which states in regulation that if a subcontractor performs a majority or vital components of a given subcontract, that that subcontractor will be treated as an affiliate of the prime contractor. And so if you have a dissimilarly situated subcontractor who's performing all the work, right, or at least all the vital parts of that particular contract, that raises serious issues with respect to how these set-asides are actually functioning.
All right. I got a question from Kevin about are there any books or guides that would recommend for someone who's just starting out in the government contracting universe? So this is a shameless self-plug in that this firm has written about 350 to 400 blog posts on our website specifically related to the universe of government contracting. That's probably an easy place to start. We've also put together, there's some videos out on our website and our resources page that'll help with that. But there are also, you know, there are other attorneys. Steve Koperentz up in Kansas has written some good books on government contracting for small businesses. The SBA, by the way, is an excellent and free resource, especially if you are service disabled, or I'll just say SDVOSB for short. Make an appointment. Any new contractors, make an appointment with your local SBA office to get in and use all of their free resources. Also, every state will have a PTAC, P-T-A-C. That's another free resource that's partially funded by the Department of Defense that will help you. And again, it won't charge you a dime. We participate in PTAC. We do free webinars for that group to help them. And they exist in virtually every state in the union and will help you with those resources. And there's print literature and online literature on all of those places. We are now officially out of time. It's 11:31. Now, we're not, as in the self-imposed deadline of 11:30, that we wanted to be fair to everyone who's joined us. We anticipate, well, not anticipate, what we're going to do is we're going to take all of these unanswered questions that exist in both the chat and the Q&A. And what we're going to do is Joel and I will put together short videos, you know, to try to address those questions, get those out to you via email. We got some nifty little tools that make it easy so you don't have to, you know, download big videos. You'll be able to see them in your search, in your Chrome or your whatever browser you're using. And so, you know, that's how we'll address the rest of those questions. Understand, as Joel started off, you know, this is the first of five of these webinars we'll be doing on a monthly basis. Again, there are a myriad of ways to reach this law firm through our website. You can submit your questions in forms online. And there's you can even create an appointment with me for 15 minutes at your leisure for any other questions you may have if the videos we send don't do the job. But we want to thank everybody who has joined us today. We greatly appreciate the time you've taken out of your busy lives. We want to be respectful of that. And so we know there are outstanding questions, we will address those. And with that, we bid you all adieu and thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.